Well, hello, folks. You know you're in for a treat when you hear that tune, because it means it's time for episode 567 of the Rec Poker Podcast. This is the chats edition, but we also have a forums edition every week just talking the strategy. I'm your host, Jim Reed, Bluffsterini in the home game and at Rec Poker Jim on Twitter. And I have the best freaking job in the world, hanging out here with my friends, talking poker on the podcast every Monday at 7:30 Eastern for free live on YouTube. So come and join us out every week, and you can win a prize just for showing up. We're going to talk to Matt Affleck in just a minute. We got him back, gang. We had way too much fun last week. We only got scratched the surface of the list of questions we had for this fantastic player and coach. So we're going to talk to Matt again in just a moment. But first, I have to mention that we're brought to you by the Running Aces Hotel, Racetrack, and Casino. They are the official sponsor of the Rec Poker Podcast. And most of what we do here is free. We're a largely volunteer-based organization. So we really depend on support from our sponsors and from our premium members who take part in our training material and study opportunities for only $15 a month. And you can always get your first month for only $5 using the code RECPOKER at checkout. And even if you want to just see what we're all about and not spend a penny, come get a free account here at Rec Poker. All it takes is an email address and a smile, although we do insist on both. We've got a ton of resources and tools and friends and mentors available for our free community members here at Rec Poker. Now, they let me host the show on Mondays, but I am just one man. It takes a crew, a group, a village, a gang to make the magic happen here at Rec Poker. We call this group of wizards the Wrecking Crew. And if you want to find out more about me or the rest of the Wrecking Crew, you can go to rec.poker/crew. But you can also just listen up. You're going to meet a few of them right here on the show tonight, starting with none other than our producing co-host, the irreplaceable, the one and only, the man, the myth, the legend, Chris Jones.
Well, I'm Chris Jones. You can find me 5v5 on Twitter, 5x5 in the Poker Stars home game. And I run our deep dive strategy segment, which we're going to talk a little bit with Matt about tonight, a little bit later in the show.
And my name is Joe Koulis. You can find me at JoeCoolPhD on Twitter, as well as Blue Sky, or LV11 in the home game. And beyond being the local pretty face for this organization, I also run the PSYOP. Help you understand psychological concepts as they apply to poker.
And I'm John Somsky, also known as Poker Geek MN Everywhere. And they may keep me around just because everyone else feels better that way when they know they're at least better than someone. And I organize our home games.
Hey guys, I'm Joseph Wills. I am Hockey_Poker on the X Twitterverse and Hockey_Poker 702 in the home game. Not only do I have the Be a Better Fish series on the website, but I'm also the man behind the scenes in our Learning Partners program.
And I'm Keith Brandt. That's Monkey System just about everywhere online. And I run the Monkey's Off Table Tools segment every month.
I'm Kim Kilroy. I'm PetBet33 on social platforms, Fergie56 in the home game. And once a month, I run a hand history review group where we take a deep dive into a hand or two that people have played, usually at live games. And I also run a travel forum. So come on, join in.
And I'm Rob Washam. You can find me as Rabman50 just about everywhere. And on the first and third Wednesdays of every month, you can join me and a bunch of our premium members as we discuss the latest books.
And as you can tell, we've got a full packed room. We've got a Brady Bunch panel, a Hollywood Squares grid set up when people found out that Matt Affleck was coming back. It was like, well, we got to talk to this guy. Matt, thank you so much for coming back on the Rec Poker Podcast. First of all, just wanted to say thanks for coming back. Welcome back, buddy.
Yeah, look, I enjoyed it last time, so you threw out the offer, so it sounded fun.
That's it. Let's run it back. So let's just dive in. People already know your poker story. We had so many great questions last week. I'm just going to pick up where we left off. So I'm going to start with one of the questions we got over Twitter when we announced that we were going to be talking to you again today. This is from Evil Roy Slade. He goes by Dave Westerveld in the real world. Fantastic guy. He was playing in a WSOP event with you, actually, 10 years ago. And he said, I asked your question. It's amazing. As recreational players, we have these spots in our mind that just stick with us. This was a $2,500 event, and it stuck in his mind. He played with a bunch of pros that day, and you were one of them. He said, he asked you about a spot he took, which was like a high variance spot, restealing with a short stack later in a day. And you said something about how being a less experienced player, taking a high variance approach can sort of like negate the skill edge that some of the more experienced players have. So his question is, can you just in a vacuum or in the abstract, can you just talk a little bit about taking a higher variance approach to benefit yourself as a less experienced player? And sort of like when you look around the table and you realize, huh, I might not actually have a skill edge at this table. What are a couple examples of some high variance lines that you might take as opposed to a typical strategy?
Yeah. So in general, I don't even have to say like a weaker player, but if you're in a spot with a tougher player that's in position, for example, even myself, if I'm up against, let's just say I'm out of position and I have the option to like call a 3-bet or 4-bet preflop against a weaker player, I might potentially just call due to having like thinking I have a pretty significant post-flop edge. But versus like a player that I perceive to be pretty well studied or a pretty like someone that I respect, I might just try to make the pot a lot bigger out of position and go with the 4-bet option. And that's like a general like for recreational players or spots where they feel really uncomfortable, like out of position. If you have a good hand, like just making the pot bigger out of position is going to negate the impositional advantage or like the skill advantage of a better player. So in general, in those spots, like the most common spot, like you mentioned, like a tournament, often rejamming like 20 big blinds, 30 big blinds, even 40 big blinds. A lot of like players don't recognize that, you know, ICM withstanding, like the button opens and they're opening pretty wide. You can just shove like 40 big blinds with any pair from the big blind. So like those are the types of spots where the weaker the player you are, you probably just want to shove with those hands. Versus myself, I'm probably not going to shove with the worst pairs because I have a pretty significant post-flop edge in most situations. But a lot of players would be better off just shoving and reducing the skill edge of the imposition player.
And so is it going to be, I think as recreational players, there's some tension there because we don't want to like, you know, punt. And so there's the sense of, oh no, I should kind of play it safe, see a flop, like make a hand and then get my money in. But that's actually like a loser's mentality, right? And it's a way to get yourself in more trouble. Just speak a little to that point and then we'll move on.
Yeah, I can't remember if we talked last week about it, but just in terms of like variance tournament poker, it's really just based off your win rate and the size of the field. So if you're like actively choosing a lower EV option, you're actually increasing your variance because you're lowering your win rate at a very basic level to think about it. Another common situation just to like would be if you're say deep stack like 100 big blinds and I raise ace king off and a player out of position 3-bets me, it's a very common spot where you actually can and should mix like a lot of calls. And the weaker the player, the more I'm going to call, like probably just never 4-bet there with ace king. And then against stronger players, I'm going to consider 4-betting a lot more in that type of a situation there. So that's like another situation where like a weaker player or a rec or someone that feels like they're going to be outskilled post-flop probably just wants to always 4-bet there and make the pot bigger. And it makes it a lot more difficult to make a mistake post-flop.
Yeah, lower that SPR so there's less behind, so the post-flop mistakes aren't as big. Okay,
exactly.
I love that. So Wrecking Crew members, we got a full house tonight. If anyone wants to ask any questions for Matt, just unmute here in the panel. And then, of course, if you're in the YouTube chat, if you have any questions, just type them into the YouTube chat. We're also going to be doing our raffle at the end of the show to give away a prize to help in our fight to raise awareness for food banks around the world. And it's also a fantastic week to donate to Rec Poker through a super chat. We got our very first super chat from YouTube last week from our own Rob Delaney. And for every super chat donation that we get, we will share a portion of those funds with a local food bank. So YouTube chatters, you've got some jobs to do. And we also need three famous poker players' names to play Stake, Study, Stack with Matt at the end of the show. We'll skip our closing the action segment because we hit them with our 20 questions last week, but we'll do a brand new Stake, Study, Stack with our man, Matt. So YouTube chatters, get involved. So we had a couple questions in particular I'm looking forward to. So talk about opportunity cost when it comes to studying inefficiently. I'm just going to set you up, Matt, because we almost got into this last week. But talk about studying efficiently and the problem of opportunity cost when it comes to studying poker.
Yep. I think people in general, the most common thing for players that are struggling to improve in their game, they just, most players, professionals, recreationals, I think study very inefficiently. And I think it's just best to just study one very, very, very specific topic at a time and just kind of piece everything together. And it more so has to be with, you just want to understand the mechanics of how spots work rather than memorizing specific, you know, whether it's a solver output or how a hand plays in this situation. You want to more understand the mechanics of like what's going on so you can apply it to other situations. So a lot of it just has to do with learning in a way that allows you to apply what you've learned in very similar situations. Learning to like differentiate like small details. So by studying one thing and looking at the same thing over and over again in different permutations just allows you to see what are the nuances and what little changes allow bigger changes to occur in your strategy. So when I'm talking about like a very specific thing, like very common one would be c-betting the turn and why learning why you want to be more polarized using big sizings after you've already bet the flop and like the big blind is called, for example, and learning the mechanics of just looking at turn c-bet spots. What value hands do you want to check? What value hands do you want to bet? What bluffs do you want to use? What characteristics do those bluffs have? And looking at those situations over and over again and then kind of moving on to the next thing after that.
So just like swapping out variables, but keeping a lot of the context the same so that what you're learning is how the differences affect the outcome, right? So we're not just trying to memorize a table or a chart or something like that. Because I think this is a big gap, especially for recreational players, is we study, and some of us study a lot, and we have time to study. But maybe we don't focus it very well. And then we get to the tables and we feel like there's this application gap where it's like we've learned all this, we've studied all this, we just get into a spot and maybe we feel like there's competing factors. We just don't know which way to go with it. Can you talk to me a little bit about sort of just like solving that gap between knowledge and application? And what can we do, assuming we're doing a good job away from the tables of studying? Yeah. What can we do like at the tables to sort of just get our heads straight and focus on what's actually important?
Yeah, so it's kind of like, so when you are studying, a good thing that will help you apply better is you want to change like one variable at a time when you're studying. So for example, if you're using a program like GTO Wizard, for example, to study, and you're looking at a turn c-bet spot, we'll just keep with that example. Mm-hmm. And let's just say the flop is queen 7-4 and the turn is a deuce. And you want to learn to change one variable at a time. So like on a turn as a deuce, it's a complete blank. It doesn't change anything on the board. You're probably going to play very, very polarized with very big bets. What happens when that deuce becomes like a 4 or a 7, where now a lot of the medium strength bluff catchers that the big blind check called with turn into strong hands? How does that affect your betting strategy and position? What happens when that card is a jack or a 10? And you kind of want to like group these cards into different types of categories. Mostly, did it improve a lot of the bluff catchers into made hands for the out of position player? Another way to change one variable at a time is to change the stack depth. So if you're looking at a spot where you're say 30 big blinds deep, what happens if you double the stack depth to 60 big blinds without changing anything? Does your bet size increase? Does your bet size decrease? Do you bet more often? Do you check more often? What happens in those situations? Changing you know, looking at the like changing the suit of a card, for example. What if it brings in a double backdoor flush draw? What if it completes the front door flush? Like, always be asking yourself and changing like one variable and see what happens to your strategy. And then that way you can like cross-check that in other situations. And then you're learning, okay, this is why I'm doing this, because it's this variable that's changing. If you're changing multiple variables at a time, that's when you don't really learn. Because it's hard to apply. And this is why, like we talked about last week, if you're looking at like a hand history of 100 different hands and you're looking at like C-bet spots and check raise spots and 3-bet pots, you're changing tens, like too many variables to really like focus in and really focus on one type of situation. So, and when you're playing hands, let's say you get to a spot where you're uncomfortable. That's the same thing. Ask questions like, what would I do if this was this card instead? You know, types of situations. Mm-hmm. Like learning, changing one variable at a time is very key in terms of learning and learning what actually matters to the strategy.
And I guess that also kind of helps people think in terms of what would I do with other parts of my range here as well. Because that's another thing, like recreational players we're very good at playing exactly the two cards that are in front of us, but kind of putting ourselves in the space of, well, what if, those hypotheticals are a little trickier. So when you're playing, Matt, let's say the flop action occurs and, you know, we're waiting for the dealer to bring the turn. Are you visualizing different turn cards and sort of what actions you might take depending on what like bucket those turn cards come into? Is visualization and anticipation a way that we can kind of prepare ourselves to have the answer when the time comes?
Yeah, that's a big thing that I'm always doing. So whether it's pre-flop, and like a big thing I always like to talk about is like, let's say I raise and someone called. It's like, what's the, if it's I raised under the gun and the under the gun one player called and we're heads up, I already know I'm going to be checking a ton because I'm up against a very tight flighting range and I'm setting myself up for, I'm most likely going to be checking a ton regardless of the flop, unless it's like some very specific flop situations. Versus if I raise under the gun and the big blind calls, I'm going to be c-betting a lot in a lot of situations. The same thing applies post-flop, like after you c-bet, the turn card comes. So I'm a big proponent of pre-flop study, and it really helps your post-flop game. So kind of like, let's say I'm raising under the gun and the big blind calls. I think of my range automatically as like offsuit queens and suited nines. So it really helps set you up that if the flop comes like 8-4-5, you kind of miss that flop. Versus if the flop comes, you know, queen jack 10, you obviously hit that. It's really hard to basically not have a pair on that board. And you can apply that to turns as well. So if the flop comes, you know, whatever, 10-9-5, and the turn, if you raise under the gun, you know, you're playing offsuit queens like king queen, maybe you're playing queen jack, if you're playing loose, ace jack, and you know low cards, like you miss the flop now, and then let's say the turn is a jack, well, now you have to bluff with some pretty strong hands like ace queen and ace king, because everything else basically has a pair. So once you start to think about your pre-flop ranges, like in terms of that, it really helps to know when you need a bluff, what cards are really good for you, what cards are not.
I love that.
That helps a lot with like, you raise the button in a tournament, like the bottom of your range is offsuit eights. Like there's a huge difference between a 7-5-3 board and an 8-5-3 board, because on 8-5-3, you have all the top pair combos on the offsuit side. So once you can start to memorize your ranges as like, I raise offsuit eights and suited fives, it really helps to know which flops you connect with.
And I guess that's also true for opponents too. You know, the better we get at visualizing pre-flop ranges, the easier everything gets post-flop, because assuming we're putting our opponents on good ranges, like you can just, well, let me ask you about that. Maybe that's not true. How much of this are you doing in your head while you're playing? You have a sense of what this other player's range is, whether it's an opening range or whether you opened and they called. And you're going through the flop and the turn and you're narrowing the range. Is this something that you're actually doing sort of like combo by combo intentionally in your mind, or are you just sort of like feeling it based on your internalizing of the material over
there? No, I'm not doing it combo by combo, but I'm very actively doing it in my head, and I do it how I kind of mentioned there, where it's like I'm doing, you know, like a common one would be like, you know, you raise the button, the big blind calls. Like, we don't know exactly what the big blind range is, but I'm going to base off like the big blinds defending all suited hands and offsuit sixes is kind of like the bottom of the big blind defending range versus the button. And so when the flop comes like queen four deuce, for example, and they check call, like they probably don't have a really good queen because they didn't check raise. So they're kind of capped there. It's like when they check call, they're capping themselves in terms of like they probably don't have sets two pair or really good queen X. And they probably don't have a four or deuce very much. And the reason I know that is because they don't really have offsuit fours and offsuit deuces preflop. Mm. So a lot of their range is going to be like ace highs, king highs, backdoor flush draw type of hands. They'll have some suited fours and some suited deuces. But a turn four there isn't as scary as, let's say, if it was queen six deuce, where I know they're, you know, probably calling with offsuit sixes or offsuit sevens in terms of that, where they're going to have a lot more combinations of, you know, 7-6 off, 8-6 off, 9-6 off, 10-6 off. So when you kind of really start to learn your preflop ranges, it helps a ton with post-flop play.
And when you're talking about the range of hands that they call with, you're saying like offsuit sixes, you mean like hands where the lowest card is
yeah,
six.
Exactly. And yeah, when I say offsuit sixes, yeah, I'm talking like 7-6, 8-6, 9-6, 10-6, jack six, queen six.
Cool. Yeah, I'm always interested in the terminology that different players use to just like shorthand some of this stuff. Happy birthday, Joe Coolis. I see you in the YouTube chat. Enjoy it, man. You only turned 30 once. I mean, really soak up the pleasure from the day. Get everything you can out of it. Congratulations. Happy birthday.
Thank you very much.
Glad to have you here. Rob Washam, you unmuted. Do you have something for our man Matt here?
Yeah, it's kind of related to what we've been talking about. I've seen a couple of your videos where you do live, you know, coaching, and you're going through ranges. And when you go through ranges, you look at, you know, stack sizes and look at the bottom of the offsuit range, mm-hmm. and then the bottom of the suited range. So it's kind of like a rectangle that you're kind of looking at in your mind. And then, of course, the suited hand or the paired hands are just whatever, however far down you're going to go with the pairs. And I like that concept of how you're looking at the ranges. And I can hear it when you're describing these situations that you have the, you know, the offsuit sixes is the lowest and the suited fours are the lowest. What I'd like to know is what kind of things do you consider when you either expand or contract that range? Are there things, I mean, obviously you're not going to just blindly follow a range just because you're told to, right? Yeah. I mean, this is something you need to really get a grasp of what the best ranges are, but then what kind of factors do you consider when you're going to either expand that range or narrow that range?
So like a very common one would be it folds me on the button. I think I have two weaker players in the blind. I'm going to raise a lot more. So an easy way then to know how to expand is like I normally raise offsuit eights. I'm going to raise and mix like my offsuit sevens. I'm going to raise all my offsuit sevens and maybe I'm going to raise some of my offsuit sixes. The kind of post flop, then what you have to do is you have to play more passively post flop because you're coming with a wider range at that point and your bluffs are going to be further down later on in the hand. So then I know. So a nice way of thinking about your range is basically like in a standard spot, the bottom of my button opening range is offsuit eights. And I keep mentioning the offsuit side and kind of ignore the suited side because offsuit hands are way more important because you have three times as many offsuit hands as suited hands. So if I have offsuit eights and let's say the board comes king 6-5-4-3, something like that, a lot of my bluffs are probably going to contain an eight in it because those are the worst hands I have. Now, if I'm expanding my range and let's say there's weak players, I'm raising offsuit sixes, I probably don't want to bluff as much with my offsuit eights because I have offsuit sevens and offsuit sixes. So when you start to think about that, it really helps. And we can even expand on that. Let's say I raised my offsuit sixes, and now there's a six on the board. Well, now the bottom of my offsuit range is offsuit seven, so I'm probably going to be bluffing with a lot of 7x, right? Like offsuit seven hands throughout the hand. If there's a seven on the board, now I'm bluffing my offsuit eights because I have a pair of sevens and a pair of sixes. I don't want to bluff with those hands. So that's kind of an example of how it helps you post-flop to know what types of hands you want to bluff with, because it keeps tracks of like what the bottom of your range is. And then just to add on to what Jim was asking before, and it kind of applies to your question of like what I'm thinking about in terms of ranging. Once an action occurs, the first thing I think about is like, what hands can I eliminate from my opponent's range? So whether they call preflop, I like to think about, can I eliminate, what pocket pairs can I eliminate, like the best ones? Like, can I eliminate jacks plus? Did they call on the button? I can eliminate nines plus or tens plus, whatever it is. Can I eliminate ace king, ace queen? Because I want to know where my like nut advantages are in those spots. And I'm doing the same thing on the flop. Comes queen six deuce. They just call. I can eliminate probably ace queen, king queen, maybe queen jack, pocket sixes, pocket deuces, queen six, queen deuce. Maybe not eliminate always, but enough of the time that it doesn't make that big of a difference because they're going to check raise those hands. And that really helps now knowing that, well, queen 10 is the nuts. Like, if they're check raising queen jack, when you have queen 10 and the turn comes, you know, an eight, you can just bombs away now because, like, so thinking about in terms of that, of like eliminating hands, and that it helps with like kind of knowing where your nut advantages are and really realizing like queen 10 is 100% equity hand pretty much. Versus a lot of people just don't, they just think about it as like a one pair hand.
I love, you can see the smile on Rob's face get bigger and bigger as you were answering that question. That's fantastic. Chris Jones, you had something, I think.
Well, Matt, I want to kind of expand. I love what you're saying about studying by topic. It's actually one of the things that we're trying to do, kind of breaking down topic. We're trying to do with this, our monthly topic where we study something as a community. And I think it's a great way to learn. And I think it's something that we've tried to do, like have the whole community start to study a certain topic. And so this month we're looking at draws and how to play draws, particularly in situations where we don't just want to, and I think this is something that recreational players really struggle with. They either play draws to like foot to the gas, full pet, like they've heard that draws are a good bluff. So here I go.
Yeah.
And then the other side is they hear, well, I don't have a made hand yet, and I like to be more careful, and I like to know if I'm where I'm at. So they play them way passively, and there's not that in-between thing. And so we've been, I've just been curious what your approach, I have a sort of a more specific question, but just in general, what is some of your thought process when you're on a draw?
So it's kind of funny that like the way to learn how to play your draws is probably to learn the opposite end, is like how you're playing your value. So how you want to play your draws is basically how you want to play your value. So for example, you know, if the board is 7-6-5 and you defended the big blind, you have a lot of hands of value. You have 16 combos of 9-8. You're going to have 16 combos of like 4-3. You have lots of two pairs. Maybe you have sets, whatnot, depending, like you have a lot of value. So you can, when you have a lot of value, now you can check raise a lot of draws, right? So it really depends on how you're playing your value. If it's a spot where you just, if the flop comes ace, king, deuce, and you call out of the big blind, you don't have aces, you don't have kings, you don't have ace, king, like maybe you have ace, queen, or ace, jack, you just don't have a lot of value to check raise. So you're going to actually play your draws in a lot more like, you know, your 5-4s and that type of stuff. Maybe you check call some of them, and now you have very easy bluffs when it goes like check, check on the turn. So like learning how to play your draws, a lot of it just comes down to how you want to play your value in spots. In terms of like playing draws as a general, very general heuristics, like you check call with the ones that have a lot more like showdown value. So people tend to check raise a lot more with like pair and a flush draw, where you actually tend to check call with those ones and you want to check raise weaker draws. For example, so you kind of play your draws in a little bit more polarized way, where you check raise like your worst ones and your best ones, and then call the middling strength ones. In a way, I actually was working a couple of weeks ago on a lot on like a spot that I was struggling a little bit with was playing. I was check folding too much with weak draws out of position on the turn. So it goes check call flop, and then you get barreled on the turn. And that was a spot I've been working on that's actually led to, I'm actually, like check raising a lot on the turn now, due to a like population tendency where I think people just bet way too many middling strength hands on the turn where they're supposed to be more polarized. And I think they bet way too many second pairs or weak top pairs on the turn. And then, start check raising a lot with, you know, you're going to turn a lot more two pairs and stuff. You can do check raising for value thinner and check raising a lot of the draws that don't really want to check call on the turn.
Well, let me follow up because that actually kind of leads into so this will be familiar to some of the folks who've already started to look at some of our materials. But this is an example spot that we've been looking at a lot, talking about a lot, and I'd be curious about sort of like based on some of the things you're sharing, like how you would break it down. Okay, so very simple kind of spot. We have opened in the hijack. We're 50 big blinds deep. We open in the hijack, and the small blind has called us. And we go to a flop, and the flop is jack of spades, nine of hearts, three of spades. Jack 9-3 with two spades.
Okay.
So we're going to have both of us are going to have a shit ton of draws, basically.
Yeah.
So how are you thinking about, you know, whether you've got queen 10 offsuit, queen 10 of spades, 7-8 of spades, 7-8 of hearts, whether you've got ace six of spades, whether, you know, all the varieties of draws that you can have in here based on kind of the pieces that you were trying to tease out there. How are you thinking about which ones, let's say the small blind checks to you, which ones of these are you thinking about checking back? Which ones of these are you thinking about betting, and how do you make those kinds of decisions?
So when you're thinking about like check raise bluffing, you really want to think about how your hand does once you get called and like, what are the majority hands? Like when you check raise there, like hijack bets and you check raise and they call, the most common hands they're going to have are probably a jack, you know, maybe a nine. So you like a very like easy kind of rule thing to think about. Then when you think about it that way, you kind of want to check raise your draws to have an overcard to a jack, because then you have an additional, like you want to have additional outs against the top pair. And that's what makes like why you don't check raise that much on ace high boards, because it's really hard to have a lot of equity against an ace when they check, like when you check raise and they call. So having like an overcard, so like I would be check raising a lot of my like queen eight of spades or king eight of spades or something like that. And I think you said what, jack 9-3?
Jack whereas 9-3, two spades.
I might just like check call like a 5-4 of spades. And part of that is because one, we don't have an overcard to the jack. And then two is the more money we put into the pot, or the more we put in aggressive action, then they're going to fold hands, right? And that's going to make the odds that they have a higher flush draw like bigger and bigger. Like, so if we check raise the flop and then bet the turn and they call again, they're going to have a flush draw like 20% of the time or something, because they're never folding a flush draw. So now it's like you're kind of killing the outs of like your 5-4 spades, versus if you have king 4 of spades there, like, and you flatted the small blind, or king 5 of spades and you flatted the small blind there, now you have a clean overcard, plus you're going to dominate some of his flush draws, especially if you have like, say, ace high, like a weaker ace high. So I would like check call like, you know, ace queen of spades, ace 10 of spades, maybe even ace eight of spades, like, and then be check raising a lot more weaker high low. So those draws, like another good rule is like you want to really check raise the high low, and you check call with like the double high ones. So what I mean by high low is like you'd rather check raise ace four of spades, because you benefit from folding out ace five, ace six, ace seven, ace eight, ace 10, ace jack, well, not ace jack, ace queen, whatever, by the river you can fold out ace queen. Versus if you check raise ace 10 there, a lot of the hands that fold are ace 8, ace 7, ace 6, ace 5, ace 4. There's a lot of hands that fold that you don't need to fold, like 10, 7 suited or whatever. Like you dominate a lot of hands. So do you actually like fold out better hands is another property that I would be thinking about there.
Awesome.
Summary, just have an overcard to the top pair and then high, low. You want to maximize the amount of hands that dominate you that fold.
Love it. So we've got a couple very particular questions. So recreational players, we tend to limp. We tend to, like, there's like some common mistakes that recreational players make. We open limp. We lead into the aggressor, you know, donk betting on the flop. There's other ways that we kind of stick out like a sore thumb. But someone asked me, are there times when good players do open limp? Are there times when good players do donk the flop? And I said, probably very rare exceptions to the generally they don't. And I'm sure there would be some good answers for it. I'm going to guess that you might open limp in spots where there's a lot of pre-flop raising and re-raising, and you just want to see boards without a huge investment pre-flop. And I'm guessing the donking is really board dependent more than anything else. But can you speak to those two kind of fishy actions as people describe them to me?
Yeah, pre-flop limping, in general, if I see it in a student that comes to me, like it's just the easiest kind of low-hanging fruit. It doesn't take much coaches to stop doing that, and we'll deal with that later. They're, the only thing, it's times it really happens in tournaments is when you're like sub 15 big blinds and like the button and the cutoff, basically, or when you're in the small blind, obviously. But those situations are few and far between, and so it's not really worth complicating the strategy at all. So open limping, there's just not very many situations where it's going to be very profitable. Limping behind is definitely a thing, though. Once someone has limped, you can definitely limp behind, and the types of spots you want to be doing that with, or you want to limp behind with hands that play really well multi-way and can make the nuts. So like a ace deuce suited, ace three suited, those types of hands are the hands you really want to be, maybe small pairs like deuces through sixes. The weaker hands that can still make pretty nutted hands. And then in terms of like donk leading, it does happen, but it's on very specific boards, as you mentioned. So again, we can use the preflop range example of how it, like, so button raises, big blind calls, button's going to be raising. Like I'm talking tournament ranges because I focus on tournaments mostly. Button raises offsuit eights, big blind defense with offsuit sixes. So the easy rule, the only time there's going to be leading is where it's three cards below a seven. And there's got to be a straight on the board. Why does there have to be three cards below a seven? Well, in the big blind, we have offsuit sixes and offsuit sevens, and the button's range starts at offsuit eights. So they miss the flop. We connect with the flop some, and we have a lot of hands that want to get some protection and some value. And so those flops actually have a reasonable amount of leading on them, but they are, you know, few, there's seven high flops aren't that common.
right.
So that's the only time really that you're doing leading is when you kind of have an advantage in terms of, you know, wide range, and you have a few more pairs on the board and like combinations of straights that the raiser doesn't have.
Yeah, I like that. That's great, great answer. So when we were talking about having you back on the show tonight, you mentioned that you normally play online on Monday nights, but you had so much fun last time. You'd come and do the show and then go play some cash live in Vegas. A, I want your life. That sounds freaking delightful. B, I know you specialize in tournaments, but this is an important question. So let's say you're playing cash and you typically would chop the blinds with the person to your left, but you've got the kind of hand that might make a jackpot if you see a flop. Is there like a code word or an expression that you can use to indicate to the person in the big blind that you don't want to chop?
I don't think so. So I tend to actually not chop my blinds. However, I see this all the time. The only room here in Vegas, I think, that does the jackpots and stuff is Venetian. But like, I would be very surprised that if it's ever a good idea to run it, even if you have a jackpot hand. I'm assuming the money they take out of the pot is not worth running a jackpot hand. So that would be my answer. But I don't, considering that's something that doesn't really apply to me, that I would think that it's just never worth the rake to run it out, because you're guaranteed to lose money basically, unless you hit whatever quads are better, which isn't going to happen very much.
Right. Final follow-up to that question. So have you ever heard of sort of like a code word or an expression that you might use in that indication?
Most of the time they just say I have a jackpot hand. I play a decent amount of live cash, but the rooms I play at don't have jackpot drops. And I tend to prefer to play at rooms that don't have a jackpot drop.
Good decision, right? That's just more in your pocket per hand, right? So that makes sense. That's the grinder's rule. All right. So I think we got an answer out of that we can use going forward. All right, so I got a couple more questions here. And YouTube chatters, we've got a great group today. I see a bunch of folks in there chatting it up, yucking it up. So get your guesses in about Joe Coolis's birthday timing and start entering some poker players' names for Stake Study Stack. And also, if you're having a good time in the YouTube chat, please consider subscribing. We have, at the moment, I think 982 subscribers. So we're 18 from 1,000. And 1,000 would be a very cool benchmark to hit. So if you're having a good time, or if you're listening along at home and want to support the show without spending a penny, consider subscribing to the YouTube channel. That would help us out a lot. Joseph Wills, what's on your mind?
Yeah, Matt. Thanks for being on again. We're talking about studying and, you know, have one specific subject that you want to look at. How do you know when you're ready to move on to the next subject?
Yeah, that's a good question. It's kind of a feel thing, but like, you don't want it. Poker is so complex and there's so many things. You kind of just want to have a baseline idea of as many spots as you can. You don't really need to master those spots until you get to like a pretty advanced level. But really just learning like the basic kind of fundamentals of how the spot works. Should I be betting here a lot? Should I be betting small or big when this spot happens? Is really like, so an example, you know, c-betting out of position is a spot that students are often come to me and they often bet way too much, and kind of just teaching them you should be betting like, you know, around 30% of the time you're almost always checking. And then when you do bet like on low boards, you're betting really big because you're kind of betting your over pairs advantage. And then a lot of times you're just playing a check and check raising a lot of your good hands and check raising some of your draws, and just learning like there, though, like the example there would be just really learning that you shouldn't be betting very much out of position when you raise and someone not in the blinds calls, unless some very specific boards come out. And even just knowing that and kind of studying that and playing some spots, learning some feel in these out of position spots, is going to be pretty good. And then you can kind of revisit that spot later. But again, it's just kind of, you want to get to like, you know, the 80% rule where you feel a lot more comfortable and not worry too much about the nitty gritty details, rather just really focusing on like just getting a general understanding of a lot of the spots.
Matt, you cut your teeth playing online. You play live a lot now. Do you have a preference when it comes to the playing experience? And do you have a preference when it comes to your ROI or your hourly rate in one or the other?
If I have a preference, like online, I think is more profitable. I enjoy live a lot and I play live. I play both and I just kind of go by what I'm feeling, and it's nice, like kind of mixing it up keeps it fresh. So I'd say on average right now, like I'm playing online 3 days a week and playing live a couple of days a week, is probably like an average week for me. But once you're like an online regular, like the playing live can get a little tedious just because of how slow paced it is. And so I've always enjoyed online. I've always enjoyed the strategy of online a lot. And it's if I had to pick one and one only, I don't know, I guess it would be really close right now. But but yeah, it's I play both equally kind of now. And I enjoy the social interaction and all that stuff of live poker. And I enjoy kind of the strategy aspect a lot more of online poker.
So we just need to get you able to multi-table live, and that would really solve a lot of the problems.
Be a lot more fun.
Might be a little stressful. Joseph Wilson.
With the online poker, you know, we've seen the things with GG and ACR and, you know, all the troubles that they've been having. Have you experienced that playing online? Because I'm guessing you're kind of up there, maybe not in the nosebleeds, or maybe you are, but have you seen an instance where, you know, something looked a little questionable, if you're allowed to answer that?
So you're probably, my average buying online isn't that high. It's probably, there's probably a misconception. Online, I think my average buying probably right now is like, I don't know, 65 or so. I tend to play lower average buy-in and play a lot of tables. So I'm playing 9 to 12 tables. And I'm basically playing everything from like 33s to 215s. And right now, obviously, there's a lot of negative stuff going on with online. And I fully acknowledge that there is, like, I play on ACR and I know there's some bots on there and I know there's like stuff going on there. I don't play on GG. I know, but there's things that go online for sure. It's one of the reasons I play a lower average buy-in, but I also think there's a misconception right now that like online is unbeatable and online poker is not very like good right now. And it couldn't be further from the truth. Like the American online poker landscape right now is unbelievable. And I'll say this fairly confidently, like for equal stakes, any European player that has access to like PokerStars and those sites would rather be playing on the American sites right now. And I live in Vegas here. I have, you know, WSOP.com. The games are amazing on there. I actually learned today, I think BetMGM might be launching soon in Nevada, hopefully. Obviously in New Jersey, they have three or four sites running on there. The American, like all the geo-fenced kind of sites are just very, 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 very good. I play a ton on Global Poker. It's probably the best site on the internet, in my opinion, right now, in terms of volume and the skill level of the games. There's a lot of money online still to be made. And so it's, you know, you hear a vocal group of people, and I fully admit, I know there's stuff going on and my win rate gets cut because of that stuff going on, but the games are still very, very beatable.
And you said before that it's important for people to play online to improve as a player. Can you speak a little about why you think that is?
Yeah, I mean, this opinion is, I mean, not for everyone. I think the only, like, when I say only, I know there's exceptions or all that, but like, if you're starting from like a basic level and you want to get really, really good at poker, you have to play online, in my opinion, because you can't get the volume in live and you can't get the experience in live. And the fact that, like, obviously, if you're starting out, you're not going to play 9 tables at a time or whatever, but I'm literally playing 3,000 hands a session. Like, and if you just think about like how long it takes to play that many hands, I played in February, I played 750 tournaments online. Like the volume you can play online, not only like the volume in terms of like making money, being able to have a lower average buy-in, lower variance, all that stuff, spreading out variance, but just the ability to like get experience. And it makes studying, like having Poker Tracker and having a complete database of all your hands is the most powerful thing. And it's the biggest study tool you can have. And basically, like, if I have a student coming to me that has 50,000 hands in their Poker Tracker database, it makes it so easy to coach because I literally have filters set up in my Poker Tracker that have them send me their database. And I can filter for spots exactly where, like, under the gun, they raise big blind calls and they checked in a spot that should be range bet. Like I can filter for boards that I know are going to be range bets and they're checking. And it's like super easy fix. Like you're c-betting, you're checking on these boards, you need to be c-betting. Same thing from the button. I can filter for preflop spots where they're folding and they should be raising. Like it's so easy to identify your mistakes in terms of that way versus in live poker. You don't have any record of hands. If I have a student playing live poker, they're not going to send me the hands that they don't think are a mistake because they don't know they're a mistake. And whether you're, you know, if your goal is to get better at poker and you enjoy live poker a lot more, which is a vast majority of people, I understand, you can still play online one night a week or two nights a week, playing some tournaments, get more experience, have some hands, have a hand history. It makes it so much easier to improve, in my opinion. And just having the ability to get more experience, more hands. And if you're working on a specific spot, like for example, you guys were working on draws in your monthly thing, you can literally filter for every single hand that you've had a draw. You can't do that live. And so like, that's just like a basic thing of why I think online poker is just really, I think it's one of the only ways to get really good really quick.
Yeah, I think that's a big 1-2 punch. We're big Poker Tracker fans here. If folks want to find out more about Poker Tracker, you go to rec.poker/resources. We've got a link there that you can use where we'll send you a free customized HUD if you purchase it through our link. I run a Poker Tracker review group every month as part of our premium membership here. And I think you said it, man. The reps, just getting the reps in online so much faster. It's better training, like muscle memory. But the database, the reliable, objective database of all the hands you've played, of all the mistakes you've made, of all the spots you didn't think were important enough to review, they're there. And not just to break down your opponent's actions and to find ways to exploit them, but to find the mistakes that you're making. We're all such terrible narrators of our own action when we're playing live, you know, like it's, even if we take notes well, we're just unreliable narrators. So I think that's crucial. Matt, is there a strategy difference from playing live to online? Do people play slightly differently with sizings or frequencies? And is that something that you have to kind of adjust from live to online, or is it no different than just adjusting to whatever table you're playing at and the players at that table? I mean, poker is a game of adjusting.
Yeah, it depends. Like if you're playing one or two tables and you can, you know, pay attention and all that type of stuff, then yeah, it's the same thing as live where you're making a lot of adjustments and stuff. When I play online, I'm playing probably average of like 10 tables. So it's a little bit more of a robotic playing my strategy and stuff. Most of my, I'd say 60 to 70% of my play online is on sites that don't allow HUDs. And a database at about 30% is. So if I can have a HUD, that's pretty, makes it a lot easier to get quick information. And for the sites that I don't, they're smaller player pools. So it's WSOP.com and global. And they're a lot, like the field sizes are a lot smaller, 100 to 200 players. And so I just have like kind of a quick note taking method of, you know, just marking weaker players, stronger players and whatnot. And so then I'm like, just generally, this player is marked as a weak player. What are my general adjustments against a weak player versus this player is a strong player, like playing a little bit more of my normal strategy at that point.
I love it. Chris, there were a couple comments and questions in the YouTube chat, and I'll just say last chance for questions. We're coming up on our hour with Matt here. This has been a great interview so far.
Yeah, I've got two that have kind of bubbled up here. One of the questions came up as we were talking about online play and about some of the concerns about game security and that. Do you play online cash? The Life Shoe Aquatic wants to know, do you play online cash? And should we be wary of online cash because of the ability to RTA and maybe more select game collude and that kind of thing?
I don't play online six max. I will like throw up a couple of tables sometimes at the end of a session, but no, I don't play online cash. And the ability to do that type of stuff is one of those reasons. It's a lot. Let's say if someone were to have a bot, it's very, very difficult to have a bot sophisticated enough in tournaments to make adjustments with ICM and different variant stack sizes and all that stuff versus in cash game where it's a lot more set parameters. It's a lot easier. I'm not an expert in security or any of that stuff. Like I'm kind of just giving my opinion in terms of like, I don't have a lot of research in that, but I don't play, like I'm kind of a play tournaments online and I play the bigger live tournaments. And then I play cash live when I do play.
And then the last question that came through was from Marcel, and he says, go Hawks. Ask Matt what he thinks the Seahawks' biggest needs in the NFL draft are this year.
Draft every player over 300 pounds. I don't want to draft a single player under 300 pounds. I have an opinion that I'd rather have the San Francisco 49ers roster and in Geno Smith at quarterback than the Chiefs roster and Patrick Mahomes. I think it's better to have a really, really good roster and an average quarterback than have a really, really good quarterback and a kind of rough roster around it. So I have this, my opinion is you win in the NFL still with offensive line and defensive line.
Awesome.
I want the fat, slow guys, or actually not slow. I want the fat athletic guys.
That's it. You want the guys that move. People say, how do they move so fast at that size? So that's what you want. All right, last question. We're just getting this in from YouTube here. Skater Die 87. I got a question for Matt. If you could not play poker, No Limit Hold'em, or PLO, what casino game would you try to master for profit?
What casino game would I try to master? Ultimate Texas Hold'em.
There you go.
If you share cards, it's, I don't know the math, but it gets very close. We had a casino.
Good answer. Good answer.
We had a casino in Washington that would allow you to buy all five spots. So you could play five hands of Ultimate Texas at once. So you're seeing, by the time the river comes out, you're seeing a third of the deck almost. And you're probably making money, I think, at that point with card removal. I think the casino is losing money at that point. I could be wrong, but if I get to see five of my hands plus five cards on the board and then make a decision to call the river or not, I find it, I think I would have an edge.
Well, we got some great comments and questions in the YouTube chat today. Thanks to everyone for your participation. Chris, is it time? Should we roll into Stake Study Stack? Are there any more questions that we want to ask our man, Matt?
Sounds good to go.
All right. We got it. We're experimenting with our new soundboard. So we tried gong last week.
Oh, boy.
Let's try this one. So we'll end the interview interview section here. Yeah, that's a little more like it. That's a little more like it.
I think that's better than the gong. That's definitely better than the gong. All right, Matt.
I'm old. I'm old, and I think that was an old reference right there.
All right, Matt. So we've got a bunch of names in the chat, and I'm going to ignore them all because we had so much fun last week, and I got you into trouble with Lexi Gavin.
I actually have an amendment to my last week. I was thinking about that after the show.
Let's do the amendment first. What do you
I got? Was thinking, why do I want to – I think I said I would stake Jonathan and stack Lexi. And then I thought, literally after the show, why do I want to stake Jonathan when he plays part-time now and only plays in 25Ks versus Lexi still playing the high-value tournaments? So I want to swap those two.
All right.
That was before she got mad at me.
I love the drama, and I'm going to get you in trouble with some of your other fellow coaches at Poker Coaching. So I'm going to give you three names from Poker Coaching roster. Stake Study Stack, you know how it works. I've got Brock Wilson, Jonathan Jaffe, and Alex Fitzgerald.
Okay. I want to, you said Jaffe,
Wilson, Brock. And Fitzgerald. Yep.
Okay. I got this one. I want to study with Jaffe. I actually think made a tweet like a month ago. I think Jaffe's content never gets talked about. I think it's some of the best content on the internet. Jaffe stuff is really, 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 really good. So Jaffe, I want to study with. I want to stake. See, this is close again. I think it might be the same situation because, like, do I really want to stake Brock in high rollers now because he's like so big time now, or do I want to like stake Alex in? You know, he's the value grinder. Like, I've known Alex for like 20 years, so we're gonna stake Alex because he's Mr. Fitzgerald, because he's going to be playing in some good value tournaments that he's never going to be losing in. And Brock's me, you know, flipping coins with Ike Haxton. So let's hope he gets stacked by Ike.
Awesome.
Fantastic. Well, thanks, Matt. Well, folks, if you're listening at home or if you're tuned into the YouTube chat, I just want to tell you that we're going to come to the end of the interview here. We're going to give away a prize. If you pull out your smartphone and Google food banks near me, you'll find an organization that can use your help. Food insecurity is a problem around the world. It affects all sorts of people. It might be people that you don't expect. It might be people in your own community, in your own neighborhood. You never know who's having a little trouble putting food on the table or feeding a child or a loved one. And it's a fantastic return on your investment when it comes to making the world a better place to donate a few bucks out of your pocket, a few hours out of your day, or a few non-perishable food items from your pantry. So just Google food banks near me and you'll find a place nearby that can use your help. In the meantime, if you type the words food bank into the YouTube chat, you will be entered into a raffle. We're going to give away a fantastic prize at the end of the show. Maybe it's a month of free Rec Poker membership. If you're already a Rec Poker premium member, you've unlocked some great prizes. You can hang out with Matt Affleck over at pokercoaching.com. Or you can hang out with some of our other learning partners. So just type the words food bank into the YouTube chat now, and we'll do our raffle after the at the end of the show here. Matt, last thought. You've been a poker coach for a long time now. You've been producing amazing training content at pokercoaching.com. What's one thing that you still love about coaching? And then we'll sort of tell our audience where they can get a hold of you and how they can get more Matt Affleck in their lives. And like, or and actually maybe like, what, let's just talk about your coaching a little bit. How much do you charge? How do you structure it? What kind of requirements are you looking for people that are looking to take the next step? Talk a little bit about your coaching program.
Yeah. I think one thing that I like about coaching that I didn't think when I started coaching is coaching makes me a lot better as a player. So it's a lot of, studying of like basic fundamentals, revisiting the common, like, because I'm normally always coaching in the highest frequency, most common spots. So I'm just getting a lot of work at those spots, which is great. From the selfish side, yes, it's like almost like getting paid to study in a way. From the other side, it's really cool when you see a student like kind of progress throughout and then making progress consistently, getting better, and like kind of the light bulb moments going off. Like that is really cool in terms of the coaching aspect of it.
What do you look for, or what do people have to bring to the table?
The type of people that I have the most success with and prefer in terms of like my ideal clientele are kind of the serious wreck that's maybe a small loser, or break even winner, or professional for that matter, but more so like someone that like they've got kind of the fundamentals. They know about c-betting, they know about the very basic actions. They have an idea about pre-flop in terms of what types of hands they should be playing, what hands they shouldn't, and that's kind of where I prefer people to have some type of introduction to a solver. They've at least seen one. They know potentially, like if I send them drills on like a site like GTO Wizard, they it's not something they've never been exposed to in terms of that. If someone comes and they're looking for, very, very basic fundamentals and they just are straight losing player, I will send them more so to the tournament masterclass, one of the poker coaching content type of stuff first. Recommend they go through that, get some more reps in, and then once they kind of reach a plateau there, that's kind of more so where like a one-on-one coaching would come in. But yeah, like taking someone that plays some online, plays some live, and they're like taking them from break even to like a reasonable size winner is like, I've built up a process that I think has become a lot better at that. And then in terms of costs, so I charge $200 an hour for coaching is my rate. That's why like openly I send people to other sources if they're trying to really just learn the fundamentals of how poker works. Like the hourly rate of a one-on-one coaching just doesn't make sense from a financial level. Taking someone from like a break even to like getting their win rates up and stuff. So yeah, $200 an hour is what I charge. And normally I would say, someone gives me like 10 hours of work, it's like I can completely change kind of how the goal is to kind of completely change how they think about different spots.
That's awesome. And people can find that at pokercoaching.com. Is there a particular part of the
presentation? Yeah, pokercoaching.com. They can go to tools, I believe, on there. And then there is private coaching there. I have a website that I don't update that much, but there's a link to my email on there. They can send me some mattaffleck.com. I'm active in the poker coaching Discord nowadays, and so they can contact me on there. They gave me like my own little channel on there, and so I'm doing some like live study streams and stuff in the poker coaching Discord.
Nice.
Nowadays, so
sweet. And
Twitter,
and
they can reach out to me on Twitter if it's something that they're interested in as well. This McMatto Poker on Twitter, but yeah, it's not something I really like out broadcasts and stuff like that, but there's a decent amount of avenues and stuff to get a hold of me.
Awesome. Well, we'll make sure all those links are in the show notes. Last question. So what does a coaching, let's say someone did, you know, 5 hours or 10 hours or something like that. Do you sort of meet with them regularly? Is it over Zoom? Is it mostly email? Give us a little flavor of what people might be in store for, and then we'll let you go.
Yeah, it's all over Zoom. My coaching, normally the first session is, like I've mentioned, is we'll do a database review or some way of reviewing your hands, just noticing your mistakes. A lot of times I'll use my database and I'll like very common spots that like I want to know about c-betting on the button, c-betting from under the gun, c-betting out of position. Like I'll present you with different spots basically and just want to hear your thought process and just basically learning, building that checklist of like what we're going to go through. And then it's kind of like, you know, each session is going to be whether it's c-betting out of position, turn c-betting, you know, turn pro betting once it goes check, check, defending your big blind versus c-bets, check raising, you know, that all that type of stuff. It's kind of like, you know, one session each on those things. And generally we'll give you ways how you should study beyond the session and some drills to do to improve. And then it's kind of frequency. It depends. Like I have some players that play a lot, we'll do every week. I have some players that don't play as much, we'll do once a month. I have some players, you know, every other week type of thing. It all depends on how much time they can dedicate.
Right on. So you really tailor it to the client. That's awesome. Yeah. Well, I gotta tell you, man, I've been so pleased and impressed talking with you over the last couple of weeks on the show here. It's easy for me to recommend to our audience. If they're interested in getting more involved, head on over to pokercoaching.com and give Matt a ring. It sounds like it would be a win-win. So thank you again, Matt. I really appreciate coming back on the show back-to-back weeks. Yeah. We had to pull a little more out of you. Any parting thoughts before we wrap this up?
Yeah, I guess something you said, like I've been considering potentially like making some content for poker coaching where maybe I take on a student in terms of a more public setting with like producing some content for poker coaching and just kind of go through that like 8 to 10 hour process of that. That's something I've been toying around with a bit of thinking about doing. So, and that would, you know, give people kind of an insight of how coaching really works, I think, in general. So
I can see that being really interesting. I think I could see people really enjoying kind of taking a ride along on that journey. I hope that you do put that together. It sounds awesome.
Awesome.
All right. Well, Matt, I'll see you in this summer. I'll be down end of June, early July. Hopefully I can put a cold drink in your hands and yes. Perfect. we'll just have to put it off until then. But thanks again. Great answers. I really enjoyed these interviews. And folks can look you up in the show notes there when they have any more information. Thanks again. And we'll see you sometime soon, I hope.
Awesome. Thank you.
All right. Well, John Somsky is going to take us through some recent home game results. And then we will announce the winner of our food drive raffle. First, I just have to mention that we've got a couple events coming up at Running Aces. And that is, of course, the Running Aces Casino, Hotel, and Racetrack, located less than an hour north of the Twin Cities in the beautiful state of Minnesota. On March 13th through 17th, it's their Pot of Gold tournament. That's a $360 buy-in. And right around the corner on March 30th, they've got their Spring Break Free Roll. So that's a free buy-in if you have a player's card at Running Aces. And I believe there's a $10 add-on or rebuy at various points throughout that tournament. But that's a $5,000 added free roll tournament. So go have fun at Running Aces, folks. You're going to have a fantastic time like we always do there. John Somsky, who's been racking up the points in the home game club recently?
Well, here's a name we've hardly ever heard of. Evil Roy CA, David Westerveld, won his first nightly victory for the year. Of course, this is his 67th lifetime victory.
My.
Freak Out Yonder, private name, won their first nightly victory and their first victory at Rec Poker altogether.
Right.
K Poker wannabe Ron Payton got his third nightly victory for the year.
That's on a
Poker
roll.
Geek MN John Somsky won the daily mixed event.
Of course it was a mixed event. Way to go, John. Congratulations.
Poker Loon 91 got the international, their first international victory for the year. B-Chip, Charles Allen got his first international victory for the year. And E. Anderson 85, Eric Anderson, won the LPP event, so he can contact info at rec.poker for his free month at Learn Pro Poker.
That's right. So cooler than that one. So
oh, I cool. saw that. Was that? Did I see that on Discord or Twitter? I heard you say.
That was Discord. Had queen nine on a queen high flop, and they had queen 10. Get out of here.
That's funny. Yeah, well, it's just one of the perks of our free community is membership in our home game club. And we do have a great time. We have a great time competing with each other for these beautiful rec poker pins. You know, free to win, but not easy. Not a lot of them out there. Rob, what are you going to do with yours? You need some sartorial choices here, I think, that allow you to display the pins.
I don't have any pins.
You don't have a single pin?
No, I lost I lost the pin I had. When I lost the hat, it was connected.
Oh yeah, I thought I brought. Oh, we never met up last time when I was down there. I was going to bring you a little care package. Okay, well, June or July, Rob, we're getting that beer, and I will bring the pins. And if you're listening at home, on these rec poker road trips, I bring pins with me. So if find me in at Running Aces or in Vegas or Ireland or wherever we're going, and I will have pins there. If we can verify that you are a Rec Poker Home Game Club winner, I can just hand you your pins and you will save the $20 shipping and handling. Same.
No, you still have to actually earn the pins. So you have to win a game to get them.
Yes.
It's not just going to hand them out.
Very clear. No. And we have a strictly regimented spreadsheet for that. So it's not even, I don't make the rules. I just look it up and see. This is all John Somps. Send your complaints to john@rec.poker, please.
All right. Rob? Did you know that there was a ROI tournament going on amongst all of the home games that were going on in February?
Tell us more, Rob. So, is this an ROI tournament in a free home game club that costs nothing to enter but has real prizes? I don't believe it.
Yes.
Sounds like it's off the charts. Please continue.
The winner of each month premium member ROI results and join us for a podcast of their choosing and the guest of their choosing, right? So they can go on and join us in this wonderful podcast where we all talk smart about poker and actually ask questions of someone that they really enjoy in the poker world. Now, let's go through the results. In February, the number one premium member was Now You Said It.
Oh, awesome.
245%.
Okay. International member. Second, I won't dox them, but congratulations.
Did you say 845%?
200.
Oh, 200. 200. Okay.
245%. Very impressive.
Yeah, there was a lot of caches in February.
And this is, and you have to play a minimum of four games. So this isn't just showing up and binking something and having a high ROI. Okay.
Right. We've had to disqualify a few people this month because they only played one or two.
Yeah.
And second place went to a Wrecking Crew member, Tom Binkley, our own Eric Jin.
Of course.
Second place premium member was Kellis 196220. Way to go, Kelly.
Go, Kelly.
The next one premium member was B-Chip, our own Charles Allen, at 88%. Then we had three Wrecking Crew members get involved in the action. Uh-oh. It was me, Rabman50, at 87%. Then East Coast Bitter at 53%, Ben Enslow.
He's on a tear.
And our own Hockey Poker 702 came in with 43%. Way to go, Joseph.
Top five, Joseph.
Not bad.
Yep. And then we go to the last two top five premium members with Stewie 13 at 36% and Now Then KB at 32%. And that rounds up the top five. And obviously it's nine players because the Wrecking Crew members don't count towards the overall ROIs. But we need to at least show them some love. They're doing that well in the rec poker home games. So there you have it.
Well, congrats to some fantastic finishes, some great performances from some premium members in our home game club. So, Rob, who is the number one overall winner with the highest ROI for the month?
Now you said it.
Okay, now you said it. I know you're a private player in our home game club, so I'm not going to dox you, but I think you're listening. So email me, jim@rec.poker, and we'll go over who some upcoming guests are on the podcast, and you can choose which week you'd like to join the panel here and talk to our guests and ask your questions in real time and make a connection. And I'll tell you something. It's crazy. The poker world is like, just come on the show, exchange a few words with this poker celebrity, and I guarantee you they're going to recognize you next time you meet them in Vegas, and it's going to be like your old friends. I'm so pleased with the way the poker world has like embraced Wrecking Crew members and our premium members that they get to meet in our Q&As or our study groups or on the podcast. They've just been, the poker community continues to be such a wonderfully warm and inviting place. Email me, jim@rec.poker. Let's get you on the show, and you can meet the poker player that you're most interested in.
I was just
concur. I get the red carpet treatment every time I walk into a Vegas casino, probably because I lose a lot of money, but
whatever. That helps.
No, I also wanted to say that, yeah, the home game is a lot of fun, and thanks again to John for putting all that together. That's amazing. So thanks for all that you do.
Seriously, John.
And I was just going to say that now you said it, his first name is public. That is Joe. So okay. We know it's Joe.
All right. And Joe, if I happen to see you, I'm going to be at the Irish Open. I'll be in Dublin for the last week of March. So if you're over there, I hope we get a chance to have a cold drink together. My treat. I hear from Joe Coolis that he was born at 11:50 p.m., barely snuck it in there on March 4th. And so, John Somsky, you are the winner of his contest in the YouTube chat. He will be donating $25 to a food bank near him in your name. So congratulations to everyone for participating in that. And thank you to Joe for his continued generosity, supporting food banks around the world, especially on his birthday.
Just to make it even more generous, I will find a local food bank around here and donate $25 in his name.
Oh, I am so privileged and pleased to be part of this fantastic group here, the Wrecking Crew. I love this group. Thank you, everyone, for your fantastic contributions to the poker world. I'm so pleased to be a part of this fantastic organization. All right. Chris Jones, we had quite a few people. This was an active YouTube chat tonight. I've got some dice ready, but we should go through. I just want to make sure we've got the same people in the same order. So I'll start. I see Cheat to Win 81, Dean, Skate or Die. Actually, no, hold on. We got to do this in the right order. Cheat to Win, Dean, Supreme Leader Army, Marcel, Stu, then Skate or Die. Cheats in there again. We're not going to count that one. They are cheating. That makes sense. They are cheating. they did say twice. That. They said they were going to do that. The Life Shuquatic.
Yeah.
And then we got to scroll down a little bit here. Looks like Arnold is 8. Joe is 9. And K Poker Wannabe is 10.
Yep. That's what I got 10 as well. Yep.
All right. And I have a 10-sided die here because I'm a big nerd. So let's roll it and see who the winner is going to be. It's number 5. Let's start up at the top again and just see that was Cheat, Dean, Marcel, Stu, Skate or Die 87. Okay, Skate or Die 87.
Challenge flag has been thrown.
Oh, no. Did I screw it up again?
Cheat to Win, Dean, Supreme Leader, Marcel, Stu is number 5.
Oh, okay. Well, Stu, you are already a Rec Poker Premium member. But you have won a free month at either pokercoaching.com, Learn Pro Poker, Solve for Why. Hold on a second now. The Poker Forge, Faraz Jaka's Jaka Coaching. I think I'm missing a couple, but Stu, send me that email, info@rec.poker. Congratulations. And you know what? I feel bad for Skater Die 87 because I gave him that momentary roller coaster hit of adrenaline thinking that they'd won. So tell you what, Skater Die, send an email to info@rec.poker. And we're going to give you a free month of premium membership here at Rec Poker anyway for your as a way of saying sorry for screwing up the the prize draw there. But thanks for tuning into the show. I notice a lot of these first time YouTube viewers are winning prizes. I'm just saying, if you're sitting at home and you're listening to the audio version, it might be time to get involved and see if you can win a prize too. All right, gang. Well, what else? We got Ireland coming up. That's going to be super fun. If you're in Ireland for the last week, I know, Kim, you're going to be there. I think Stu's going to be there as well. I know Liz is coming back because she's got a title to defend. If anyone else is going to be around, if you're going to be in Dublin for the last week of March, then hit me up. Let's go get a pint. I'd love that. And starting this week, it's Marek Madness on Tuesday nights. We're doing our head-to-head bracket style tournament. Tuesday nights in March, you can head on over to twitch.tv/recpoker and catch all the action. And we even got a ringer. Joey Ingram, Poppy himself, is one of the 16 players in the tournament, in the field this year. So someone's either going to take that guy out or he's going to win one hell of a Rec Poker pin. So either way, it's going to be a fun battle. And we are televising all the matches at twitch.tv/recpoker with live commentary to cards up action. It's going to be a phenomenal event, just like it is every year, Tuesdays in March. You can go catch your action there. All right. Well, let me see. I think we went long again. Who could have seen that coming? My thanks to Chris, Keith, Joseph, Joe, Kim, Rob, and John. Some fantastic YouTube chatters. Had a great time with the YouTube chatters this week. Keep it up. And Running Aces Hotel, Racetrack, and Casino, we couldn't do it without you. And you, the audience at home, you're the ones we get out of bed for every day. So keep listening, and we'll keep rocking on the Rec Poker Podcast.